Thank you. Good morning to all of you. Certainly a privilege to be here. To thank Mr. Welch for inviting us down to have an opportunity to speak to you and talk a little bit about some of the things we present and teach at ABC, Ambassador Bible Center. So it's good to see you all. Bring you greetings from the churches that I've been trying to take care of as best I can with all of the many hats that you wear. Nowadays, there's, I always feel guilty when you're not doing as much as a pastor for your congregations as you should be doing, and I always have those little guilty feelings in the back of my mind, thinking I could have done more, could have been more, done more for them. But that's, one of the things that we live with today. We have a lot of hats to wear in the ministry, so. Just one of those things we do. But I bring you greetings from the three churches. Bloomington Normal is kind of like one of those cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, where the two cities are kind of intertwined. In fact, even if you're a resident there, the cities are so intertwined you can't really tell one from the next or where you're at unless you've got a phone book with an actual address in front of you to tell you if it's Bloomington or if it's Normal that you're in. They have different police departments, and I don't know how they tell the difference, but you see Normal cars and you see Bloomington cars, and how do the police tell which address they're going to most of the time? So it's so very intertwined. Anyway, the brethren, of course, received the joke quite frequently about being Normal. We used to meet in Normal, and now we meet in Bloomington, so it's an interesting area. There's all kinds of jokes about Normal, as I'm sure there are about Sooner here. That seems to be one of the things that I noticed right away. In fact, I got here a little sooner than Mr. Welch was expecting me yesterday, so I shouldn't use bad puns. You know, that's not a good way to get started. let me get into my split here this morning for you. There was a story that I found a while back here about President Lincoln. Some of you have probably seen the movie on Lincoln, which was actually pretty well documented, I think, in a lot of ways. The story goes about Edward Stanton and Lincoln. He said, "No one treated Lincoln with more contempt than did Edwin Stanton, who denounced Lincoln's policies and called him a low, cunning clown. Stanton had nicknamed him the original gorilla and said that explorer Paul Duchalot, and I think that's how you pronounce it, was a fool to wander about in Africa trying to capture a gorilla when he could have found one so easily in Springfield, Illinois. Lincoln said nothing in reply. He had no response. In fact, he made Stanton his war minister because Stanton was the best man for the job. And he treated him with every courtesy, and the years wore on. Then the night came when Lincoln was assassinated, and a bullet struck Lincoln in the theater. And in a room off to the side where they had laid Lincoln's body, or it was taken, Stanton stood there over him that night. And as he looked on the silent, rugged face of the president, Stanton said through tears, 'There lies the greatest ruler of men the world has ever seen.' That was his impression. And the patience of Lincoln's love conquered him in the end." Stanton's words changed from criticism to praise of Lincoln over the years. Probably heard many stories about patience, and certainly Lincoln was one of those of great patience as he administered this country. But waiting and patience are actually not my subject. I'm going to talk about kind of the opposite, things that are instantaneous, things that should be spontaneous. And that's a difficult subject to find a story for, so I gave you an opposite story, so to speak, before I get started. But this morning I want to talk about the word immediately in the Bible. It's there, and it's mentioned, and there are lessons to learn from it, actually a number of lessons to learn from it. There are times in life that all of us should be impetuous, believe it or not. I probably shouldn't say that where teenagers can hear it, because oftentimes they're very, very impetuous in life. They're just getting started. They're anxious to do and try and flavor, sample everything. There are times to react immediately, and God tells us to do so. God is certainly a patient God, But he's also an immediate God from time to time. The Gospel of Mark is probably one of the best illustrations that I know of immediacy. It's used quite frequently in the Gospel of Mark, or that particular word is translated that way in a number of places. People often ask, how is it that John Mark, who wrote the book of Mark, how he got to write and put a whole gospel into the New Testament? That's another whole story on canonization I won't go into here, but they thought, I guess, in many ways that only apostles could write books for the New Testament, but John Mark wasn't an apostle, but he was the student of Peter. Peter didn't write a gospel, and so much of what John Mark wrote corresponds to Peter's notes and ideas and thinking on what he experienced. And that's probably the reason it's there. And it's likely it was the first gospel written as well. But the reason I give you this background, it's important to understand a little bit about young John Mark. He's a very young man, and he was probably in his late teens when Christ was crucified. He leaves himself unnamed in the book. And later, when he describes a young man who Jesus had taken, when Jesus was taken by the Jews in the garden to be crucified, a certain young man followed Jesus and the other disciples in Mark chapter 14, verses 50 and 52. That is written there, but he doesn't name himself, but it's probably him that's being talked about. So we know John Mark was present. He was a witness of some of the last events, at least, of Jesus' life. The Apostle Peter, of course, was his teacher and his mentor, and he became we know Peter's personality being very impetuous for many years as well. So we see that flavor, and some of that comes through in Mark, who he taught and trained. And so it's kind of interesting. Peter was the one who frequently put foot and mouth disease during the first 3 years or so with Jesus and walking around in his ministry. He often said things before he thought about them, very impetuous in the way he did things. Jesus had to tell him to get behind me, Satan. There were things that he had to be corrected for because he was impetuous. He was immediate in many ways. John Mark, very same thing. Very impressionable young man. And he was highly influenced by Peter as well. And he was also very impetuous in terms of demonstrating his willingness to follow Christ at his own peril, even when Christ was taken in the garden. Think about how impressionable you were when you were a teenager. Everything in life was new and exciting. Things to do, things to find out. Think about how impressionable you were. For many teens today, that immediacy is a very important thing. They want things right now. And our society tends to tell you that you can have everything you want right now. Unfortunately, that's not always the case, but society wants you to think that that's possible. The Jews, the scribes, and the Pharisees that Jesus encountered were some of the most interesting things to John Mark, so he oftentimes records the confrontation that Jesus had with them, confrontation with demons, miracles, anything that a young man would be impressed with, Mark records and writes down. Mark was highly impressed with immediacy and instantaneous miracles and all of the things that he saw Jesus do. And so it is in his writings that we learn lessons about immediacy, especially in chapter 1 of Mark. Let's turn over to Mark and look at the baptism of Jesus Christ in chapter 1 and verse 10. And we begin to see some of this immediacy and some of the things we have to learn from Mark. Chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, if I can get there. Mark chapter 1, verses 10 and 11. And immediately coming from the water, he saw the heavens parting and the Spirit descending upon him like a dove. Then a voice came from heaven saying, "You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And certainly this word immediately is here. It's actually euthios or euthos in Greek. That's the word that's often and most often translated as immediately. Nouns sometimes get spelled a little differently because there are various declensions and things that take place in the language. So the ending of the Greek word sometimes changes, but it's the same Greek word, even though it's euthios and euthos in different places. This particular word is probably most frequently translated as immediately, but it can be translated as straight away or forthwith or straight, level, or even right. It can be translated several ways. And in several of these times in chapter 1, in fact, there are about seven lessons that we're going to look at in chapter 1 from the use of this word, lessons for every Christian. Let's see what lesson number one here in terms of Mark's use of immediately here in the verses we just read about Jesus' baptism. One of the interesting things about that is that when we do what is right and it's pleasing to God, he responds immediately. And he did in this particular case, through an angel probably, but he responded immediately to Christ, what Christ was doing. The Father is immediately pleased. He expresses his desire to be show his pleasure to us, even though we don't hear him respond when he does. But when we do the right thing, God is pleased immediately, and he takes that and says, "You've done the right thing." Even though we don't get to hear him say it now, one day we will probably get him to say, we'll get to hear him say it. The Father, through the angel, did so with Christ here, and his feelings and good pleasure and what Christ had done. He reacts the same way to us when we do the right thing. Now, let's read verses 12 through 13, words used again. It says, "Immediately the Spirit drove him into the wilderness, and he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan, and was with the wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him." Again, immediately after baptism, the Spirit drove him into the wilderness. 40 days without physical food and water, and then he was tempted by Satan. The second lesson we can learn here is kind of twofold. There's actually two parts to it. The first one is in times of testing. Our times of testing actually often follow times of great spiritual blessing and growth. And we oftentimes find that when people are first baptized, that's when sometimes the trials start. Or we maybe get hit with a pretty big one. I know that happened with my daughter. It's happened with a number of people I know. And then growth, and we go through plateaus of growth. Sometimes we grow for a while, and then we level off for a while. And then there's some testing that goes on. And then we make another jump to another plateau, and we overcome, and we begin to grow again. And this plateau and cycle occurs throughout the Christian life. That's one of the other lessons here as well, that there's a plateau of growing sometimes in how we overcome and how we change. The second aspect of it, though, is really once we receive God's Holy Spirit at baptism and the laying on of hands, God begins leading us to him immediately. It is an immediate process. Conversion is, God says, okay, this is it. You've been baptized. You've had the laying on of hands. I'm working with you now. And he does so. So there's a second meaning here to verse 12 as well. Sometimes people find that right after baptism they have trials. We encounter sometimes severe trials right afterwards. And it was, of course, he was led into the wilderness immediately thereafter. I doubt that we'll have fasted for 40 days and 40 nights before some of our trials, but he did. Secondly, we also find that sometimes a new member becomes immediately discouraged after baptism. Why? Well, because God's Spirit has begun to immediately work, and they begin to see themselves as God sees them for the first time. And that can be a little discouraging. You know, when you begin to see yourself the way God sees you, it can become depressing for somebody brand new and recently baptized. So oftentimes when I counsel somebody for baptism just before I put them under the water, we talk about that a little bit. We talk about you know, you're going to see some things about yourself you've not seen before. And it may be discouraging for a while. But it's actually encouraging. Because it means God's Spirit is working. And that ought to be worth far more in terms of encouragement. And it encourages them sometimes to let them know that that's what's happening. And they shouldn't be discouraged, even though they're seeing things about themselves they had never seen before. Notice, too, the end of verse 13, it says that the angels ministered to him. The angels ministered to him. God saw to his needs. He was immediately present and ready to help. And he is for us as well. When the trials are all said and done, God is still able to take care of our needs. And he's always there. Once we've made that commitment at baptism to be his, he's made the commitment to be ours, so to speak, to be there for us. Let's move on to lesson number 3. It's kind of interesting and well as well. Verses 16 through 18 are lesson number 3. And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And then Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And they immediately left their nets and followed him. Immediately left their nets and they followed him. Simon and Andrew, of course, were fishermen. They were working in a family business, probably as fishermen. Undoubtedly, from the indications here, some like to believe that this was maybe the first contact that Jesus had with them. I don't think that's probably the case. I think he'd probably talked to them or knew them before. And maybe had prepared them even for the fact that he was going to call them one day and ask them to follow him. I'm sure it was not the first contact, but the Bible doesn't give us an indication that it was or it wasn't. But the lesson number 3 is our response to God and our master's requests have to be immediate. We need to learn to respond to God immediately. When we find out there's something we ought to do, there's something we ought to be, or we ought to overcome, or we ought to deal with, we need to be immediately responsive. That's one of the immediate lessons here. Second, as we walk through life and we find situations in which we can be more responsive to God, we need to do so. God expects us to be immediately responsive. He's immediately responsive to us as well. It's an opportunity to improve and to change and to help our Christian walk, so to speak, when he's there immediately for us. But he expects us to be immediately responsive to him as well. And you can ask yourself when certain things are thrown in your lap, how will you respond? Will you be an immediate person? Will you respond immediately the way you should? Christ is summoning us to come and follow me. In everything, not just in some things, but in everything. And in all those matters, we find Simon and Andrew responded immediately. And that's how we should do it as well. Lesson number 4 is in verses 19 through 20 in this chapter 2. He says, when he had gone a little further from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, also who were in the boat mending their nets. They were also fishermen. But they were probably priests as well, but they didn't work year-round as priests. So they were fishermen in between in the family business probably as well with Zebedee. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him. Now, they left immediately as well. We see a slight difference here in terms of what they did. It's Jesus that summons others immediately. James and John were undoubtedly very important in their father's business. Notice there were also hired hands here as well, working in the same family business maybe. And when called out by Jesus, they responded right away as well. So we see lesson number 4, the calling of God takes priority over all other relationships and over all other commitments and all other involvements. We make that agreement with our Father in heaven and with Jesus Christ at baptism. This is it. All other priorities become secondary to our relationship with God. Regardless of what else we may have been involved in life, God's relationship takes the chief priority. And it becomes something of an immediate attention for us as well. Nothing should come between us and God. Let's take a look at a fifth area here. Mark chapter 1 and verse 21. Excuse me. Verse 21. Then they went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered into the synagogue and taught. And another lesson in immediacy here. Worshiping God is our number one priority. Surprising? No, shouldn't be. First commandment. There are lots of things that God expresses about our owing him our loyalty and our first attention, so to speak. Jesus' primary motivation here was to teach. He was God in the flesh. But for Christians, our primary responsibility is to get ourselves to where God can teach us, where God can help us to learn. And that's part of maybe the major reason for the Sabbath, other than rest. Certainly we need to rest on the Sabbath. But learning from God is a very big reason for us to gather together on the Sabbath day. And teaching on the Sabbath, one day we'll be teaching probably on the Sabbath as well, teaching mankind during the millennium. And it will become a regular thing. How do you think your congregation will feel, or the group that you teach on the Sabbath, how are they going to feel when you just don't show up on Sabbath? Be a little surprising for them, wouldn't it? Well, I think we're learning some of those immediate lessons right now, aren't we? In the flesh. And sometimes it's a struggle to make sure we get to services, but it's something we find as Christians. It's one of those things we want to do. And we want to be there at all costs, and we don't want to miss. Same with the feast days. We want to be there. And that's part of our immediate response to God as well. That brings us to aspect number two of point number five. I don't know how else to explain it. Point B, maybe, of number five. The Sabbath was the primary day and the motivator of Jesus' worship and teaching. And it ought to be the primary motivator of our worship and learning as well. Notice, the Sabbath was the motivator to assemble. It was the motivator to teach for him. It's the motivator for us to learn today, but in the future, to be teachers. And that's one of the primary reasons God made it, not just to rest, but to worship as well, to come to know him, to learn, to assemble together, to learn from each other as well as from God, and to fellowship together. The most immediate priority, of course, to the Sabbath is to worship God. That's what the first commandment is all about, is seeking him first, putting him first in your life, putting him first on the Sabbath day. There are things like that we all need to be concerned with. Verses 22 to 24 contain the sixth lesson that we've got here as well. Verse 22, and they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Now there was a young man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, "Let us alone. What have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Now, the verse actually doesn't contain the word immediacy here, but the lesson is here as well, even though Mark doesn't use the particular word as well in it. But the sixth lesson in immediacy here is when the Word of God or the Gospel is taught with authority, it stirs up immediate reaction. Sometimes that reaction is positive to those who see in it the truth and are being called, but oftentimes it stirs up opposition and anger. One or the other usually is the immediate reaction, and that happens to audiences even today. Sometimes we get immediate response that, hey, this is great, and sometimes we get immediate response from some, this is not so good, or opposition to it. When Jesus taught in the synagogue and the demon cried out, he was attempting to stop him, to prevent him from teaching. That reaction is sometimes there too to the gospel and to the Word of God. The word immediately isn't used here, but it's certainly the implication is here as well, because people do immediately react to the gospel. Satan doesn't want the Word of God or the gospel taught. He doesn't want it presented to people. And he will lash out immediately whenever and wherever he has the opportunity to do so, to stop it. And here he did it through the man that was possessed with an unclean spirit. But does Satan have to use someone possessed to do it? No. Satan often works through the mind. Mr. Armstrong used to talk about the radio waves that Satan puts out that affects our carnal mind sometimes and affects us and makes us do certain things or influences us to do things. That's one of the ways that he works too. Over the years, sometimes as a local pastor, sooner or later, somebody may say something that isn't quite correct, or I will occasionally say something where I've messed up. My wife will catch me after services and say, "Did you didn't mean to say this, did you?" And I said, "Well, I think I did. What did I say?" And she'll tell me what it was I said, and I said, "Oh no, I didn't mean to say it that way." We all find that out after we've given sermons, when we've talked. Unfortunately, my wife is not with me today. She's very sensitive to scents and smells and deodorants and perfumes and whatever else she can't tolerate. She gets pretty ill for quite some length of time whenever she's exposed to that. So oftentimes she will not want to try to travel with me to an unknown area where she won't know whether she's going to be able to breathe during services or not. So oftentimes she doesn't try to travel with me. She's had too many incidences where she couldn't. So it's just one of those things we've kind of agreed it's better for her in the long run. She also had to work Friday, so it was not an option to drive down with me. So, but sometimes she'll let me know after I've spoken what it was that I said that either confused people or wasn't quite right. And then sometimes if it was bad enough, the following week I'll stand up and apologize usually for what it was that I bungled. But that happens from time to time. We are all learning. And it's interesting too, Satan will sometimes use incidences like that to his advantage. And we have to be careful with those things and try to be aware that we need to correct things, and we need to be willing to apologize from time to time and apologize immediately if we can to do so. In this story that the man was possessed, if Satan was able to get at anyone's attitude, he certainly was going to take advantage of it, and he was going to do it. And if he could get people to reject the truth and the teachings of Christ and the gospel being preached, he was going to do his best to do it. And I'm sure he does his best today to do it as well. And he has certain deceptions that we'll talk about one of those later on in the presentations that I'll give in the next, probably tomorrow afternoon. We'll talk about that as well. I think is it tomorrow morning we speak, or is it tomorrow afternoon? It's morning. Morning? Oh, both. Okay. It's probably in the afternoon then. That see what I mean? You make mistakes and you just, you get in trouble for them later. But the lesson is that you don't want to let Satan affect your attitude, because he will do so, and he'll take advantage of it immediately if he gets the chance to do so, that you become his instrument, so to speak, in what's happening. You don't want to let yourself become his instrument. In verse 29, we find Jesus and the disciples. They came out of the synagogue immediately after these events. Later in Jesus' ministry, we find him, opposition to him more and more frequently and more immediately as he spoke in synagogues, and eventually was unable to preach in the synagogues anymore because they wouldn't let him. Just as God's people sometimes are told in John 16:2, we will be put out of the synagogues, and whoever kills you will think that he does God's service. Eventually, things will become that bad. Let's take a look at lesson number 7. Now, finally, Mark chapter 1, verse 27. Verses 27 and 28 are where the seventh lesson is. Then when they were all amazed, so they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. And immediately his fame spread throughout the region around Galilee. The entire region of Galilee, of course, began to hear about Jesus and what he preached, and word about him spread like wildfire, I'm sure. Wherever the true gospel is preached and taught, people find out about it immediately. And they, as I said, either react one way or the other immediately as well. Word about him spread. Now, always because, you know, not always because people are favorable, but sometimes because they're in opposition to it. And certainly the Jews and the leadership were trying to influence the people not to be responsive and not to be immediate with him. But it does stir up a response immediately, one way or the other. Lesson number 7 is whenever God is actively at work, the news spreads immediately. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. But it spreads, and it spreads fast usually. This world's religions would say this was an excuse to say that Christianity, of course, has been offered to millions of people in this world as they see it. That their gospel about Christ has been used to convert millions and millions of Christians. Unfortunately, we know that's not the case. But they think that way. And if that were the case, of course, why didn't Jesus Christ have millions of converts after his ministry on this earth? What did he have? 120, maybe, that showed up in Acts chapter 2? Not very many, considering that the truth was told. Very clearly, he didn't have those kinds of numbers. And this immediately shows that the truth and the gospel have a very big impact on the world in terms of many becoming aware of it, but few responding to it. Many are called, but few are chosen. Matthew 20, verse 16. Many are impacted, many are exposed to it, but very few God chooses out in this age right now. The gospel attracts immediate attention, as I said, but necessarily, not necessarily true followers. Sometimes they're very antagonistic. In the millennium, we may see an entirely different approach to things as God begins to open people's minds and makes it understandable to the world and gives them the opportunity to be converted, to receive God's Holy Spirit. We're probably going to see a completely different response to the gospel. But today, in Satan's world, under his influence, without the Spirit being offered to people as often as it will be then, we don't have the same conclusions. Let me conclude briefly here. If God has spoken to you through the 7 lessons, what do you suppose you ought to respond to him? Should it be immediately? I think so.